Hello and welcome to this Expert HR podcast looking at avoiding unfair dismissals during redundancies. I'm Noelle Murphy and joining us today is Laurie Anstis, Director at Boyes Turner and updating author here at Expert HR. He's going to take us through how employers can avoid unfair dismissals in a redundancy scenario.
Well, thanks. We're going to be looking today at some of the details that employers need to watch out for. But the one message I really want to give to employers is that what we're looking for is what I'm going to call honest redundancies. So that's where the employers are approaching this process without any preconceived ideas, and with a view to minimizing job losses rather than, as I've often see happen, them having a target list of people who they've been told have to exit the organization. And I think a lot of the difficulties that employers face here can be dealt with simply by going back to the sort of fundamental principles around honest redundancies. And although you've already mentioned it, I should say that today we're only going to be dealing with the unfair dismissal aspects of redundancy. So we're not going to be looking at the additional requirements you have for collective consultation when you're making 20 or more people redundant, or at things like discrimination in the redundancy process. So redundancy, I think, shouldn't be used as an excuse for some kind of cull of unpopular employees or those perceived to be underperforming. If there are performance issues, those should be dealt with properly through performance management. In terms of what employers have to do on redundancy, well, the principles were first set out in a case about 30 years ago, and this is the case of Polkey and AE Dayton Services Limited, which some listeners will be familiar with because of the so-called Polkey principle, which is all about what if the individual would have been dismissed anyway. But it's actually got another point on how fair redundancies should be carried out. And it was said in that case that the employer should warn and consult any employees affected. It should adopt a fair basis on which to select for redundancy and take such steps as may be reasonable to avoid or minimize redundancy by redeployment within its own organization.
So they're really sound guiding principles that employers should actually look to use when they're looking at redundancy scenarios. But when it comes to looking at roles and roles that may be at risk of redundancy, do you think employers should look to seek volunteers in the first instance?
Well, my message to employers when I'm asked that question is, why wouldn't you? If you've got people who are willing to put themselves forward for redundancy, why wouldn't you let them do so and make life much easier for everybody? Now, often when I say that, I'm met with a host of different reasons why people wouldn't want to do that. People say, well, only the good people will go because they know they're going to find other jobs. We might get too many people volunteering in a particular area. You don't have to accept applications for voluntary redundancy. And it may very well be that there's good reasons in any particular case why you don't ask for volunteers. What I want is for employers to be thinking about that up front.
Because it really sets the right tone, doesn't it, if you're going to have to make a number of people redundant, if the first message is, we've got no other choice, so we have to look for volunteers in the first instance.
Yes, that's right. It's really what we're looking for here is that sort of open and honest approach in dealing with employees.
So when it comes to selecting individuals then, and actually looking to score individuals, have you any words there?
Of course, whether you need to do any formal selection depends on whether you're dealing with what's sometimes called the redundancy pool situation. And that's where there's more than one person doing the role that's going away, or there's more than one person in the group from which you have to make redundancies. There are going to be some cases in which it's simply a single person doing a single job. So I guess an example of that might be if you've got a receptionist who's being replaced by some sort of automatic entry system. But in reality, those are going to be rare. And in most cases, you are going to be looking at more than one person who could be made redundant. And you are going to have to carry out some method of selecting between them.
So once an employer has decided, you know, redundancies are required and has kind of formulated an approach that it's going to take, then it's about consulting with employees. And what exactly are my obligations as an employer for consultation?
Well, there's two aspects that I'd like to talk about on that. The first is what you have to consult about, and the second is what actually is consultation. And the main point of this consultation, as we saw from that earlier case that I quoted, is to try and find ways of avoiding or minimizing redundancies. So you have to be open to consult about almost all aspects of the redundancy situation. Nothing should be off limits, but just because an employee has suggested something doesn't mean you have to do it.
And so the second limb to this consultation, Laurie?
As for what consultation actually means, I mentioned earlier we had a case from 30 years ago. Well, this is a case from 25 years ago, and it's the case of British Coal ex parte Price. And in that case, it was said that consultation meant giving the person fair and proper opportunity to understand fully the matters about which they're being consulted, to express their view on those subjects, with the person carrying out the consultation thereafter considering those views properly and genuinely, but that the process of consultation isn't one in which the person carrying out the consultation is obliged to adopt any or all of the views expressed by the person or body with whom he is consulting. So what I take from that is that you have to tell the person what it is that you're planning to do, why you're planning to do it. They have to be given full opportunity to comment on that. You have to consider their comments. And although it's not mentioned in that case, I think it's a good idea then to come back to them and say whether you accept their comments, whether you don't accept their comments, and what you're going to do about it if you do accept some of their comments. But the one thing you're not obliged to do is to simply accept what they say about something. One thing that I always suggest to employers when they're carrying out any kind of consultation is that some of the most powerful and useful words you can use in any consultation discussion are asking the individual whether there is anything else that they want to say when you think you've come to the end of the discussion. Sometimes that will prompt something for the individual to say, but if it doesn't, and if it's written down in the notes of the meeting, then it's pretty hard, I think, for the individual to say that they weren't given proper opportunity to put forward what they wanted to do or what they wanted to say when they were, in fact, given clear opportunity to say everything or to add anything to what had previously been said.
So that kind of question would really help to kind of demonstrate that the consultation process has been meaningful, won't it? And I suppose it's that there's the obligation to consult with those who are in the workplace at the time. But what about those who perhaps are on maternity or on long-term sickness?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because that is something that's often overlooked, especially if you're dealing with large-scale redundancies. Yes, you've got exactly the same obligations to consult properly with people who may be away from the workplace through sickness absence or maternity. So you may need to make special arrangements for them, for example, home visits, something along those kinds of lines, so that they can have proper opportunity to participate in the consultation.
So if we go back to selection criteria and how we actually choose selection criteria, what kind of things should employers avoid, or what kind of things should they look to ensure are in place?
Well, I think that the selection criteria you're going to be used are something that the employer should include in consultation. I mean, in fact, in my experience, very few employers do, but especially if you've got a collective redundancy situation, I think it's necessary and also very helpful to include your selection criteria as something that you consult about. A few years ago, ACAS came up with four possible selection criteria. These were standard of work, and then a combined criteria, which was skills, qualifications, or experience. Then they had attendance record, but not including disability or maternity absences, and disciplinary record. This isn't one of those ACAS guidances that tribunals are officially supposed to take into account, but anything that ACAS says is influential, and most selection criteria will tend to look something like that.
Hand in hand with that, then, is scoring individuals who are at risk of redundancy.
Yes, and the key thing here is to be able to justify your scoring. In principle, tribunals aren't supposed to get into the detail of redundancy scoring. That's something for the employer to do and not for the tribunal to second guess. But you do have to have a rationale for the score, and it's worth including in any score sheet or form that you might use something where the people doing the scoring have to note down their rationale for the score. Apart from anything else, that helps to focus the minds of those people who are doing scoring. If I can say some difficult experience I had in tribunal when I was acting for an employer in a redundancy situation, the manager concerned was asked about how long it had taken him to carry out the scoring. And by the end of that line of questioning, the general idea was that he'd done it all across 20 individuals in about an hour one evening at home. And it was pretty hard to avoid the sort of impression that he'd been pretty much doing this while watching EastEnders. And obviously, you know, when you're looking at that kind of thing and you're saying, well, you know, it took you sort of 5 minutes to score each of these people, pretty hard to say really that that's been done properly. And having these sort of notes where people are supposed to give their rationale, I think helps focus their minds.
And so have you any kind of key points that you think those who are involved in scoring really should be mindful of when they're going through the process?
Sure. I mean, one thing is that the managers or the individuals carrying out the scoring are going to need some material to refer to. And just like this question of how long did it take you to do it, it's a bit of a classic question in tribunal as to what information the person had in front of them at the time they were carrying out the scoring. And you'd expect them to have things like the most recent appraisal, the attendance records, the disciplinary record if they're scoring on that basis. Also, if they're scoring on the basis of skills, qualification, experience, how are they assessing that? Do they have some list of qualifications or something like a CV in front of them? And one of the classic problems here is where the individual gets marked down on something like their standard of work, but in fact, they had a perfectly good appraisal the previous year. Generally speaking, of course, managers might apply their mind a bit more to the negative aspects of somebody's performance when they're scoring them for redundancy than they typically do in an appraisal. If the manager is going to put down a different score to the one that they've given for the appraisal, that's not necessarily a problem, but they need to know that they are giving a different score and they're going to need to have some kind of explanation for why there is a different score. Where you can, it's worth getting two separate managers to score independently. That's a good means of trying to minimize any sort of favoritism or individual biases. And I think also you should disclose the individual score to them so that they can comment on it. And I think you should also be prepared to disclose other people's scores to them.
So disclosing other anonymized scores to employees, that's quite interesting. What do you see as the advantages of that then?
Well, the first thing is that simply giving the individual their own score without saying what other people have got or what the kind of pass mark is a bit sort of abstract. Inevitably, this thing only works by comparison with other people. And simply giving them an abstract number doesn't really help them to comment on their scores or put forward any of their own views. It only works really if they know what other people have scored. What we don't want is people sort of picking holes or pointing fingers at other people and saying, well, you know, I did better than this other person or their mark's far too high for that. You can get around that, I think, in most circumstances by having an anonymized scores. But I think the individual's own score is only really meaningful where it's put in the context of what everybody else in the redundancy pool has scored.
So some areas that employers tell us they have difficulties in redundancy scenarios are things like bumping and suitable alternative employment. What can employers do to facilitate these areas fairly?
Well, as with a lot of what we've discussed, this is really about open consultation and communication with the employee, plus a proper effort to try to avoid or minimize redundancies. Just in case people don't know, bumping is the concept of where you or a more senior person kind of volunteers to take a more junior job. So within a publishing context, for example, you might have somebody who manages editors and you're looking to reduce numbers at that level. And you then get somebody who manages editors who says, well, okay, what I'd like to do instead of being made redundant is to be demoted to a pure editorial position. And then you should make one of the other editors redundant to make way for me. That's a bumping redundancy situation. Employers aren't obliged to offer bumping as an alternative to redundancy. And clearly there's big problems with that, particularly if you're looking at some sort of cascade of job losses down the business, but the employer has to be open to it as a possibility. And I think that's one of the areas in which this, is there anything else you would like to add or anything else you'd like to say, question, can be very useful so that you draw out any ideas that the individual has on bumping as early as you can. Part of the problem can sometimes be if the individual only raises bumping when they bring a tribunal claim. It's very easy for them at that point to say they would have taken a lower level job, knowing that they won't actually have to go through with that. So what we want is to give the individual every opportunity to raise those kind of points before it gets to a tribunal so that the employer can actually do something about it.
When it comes to suitable alternative employment then, was there anything specifically that employers need to be aware of?
How I've typically seen this done is simply by the employer pointing the individual to some list of vacancies or the intranet and asking them to apply for a job if they want one. The law says that the employer's obligations are stronger than that. The employer actually has to go out of their way to try and look for suitable alternative employment for the individual. The onus is on the employer, not on the employee. And this can include looking for vacancies across group companies. And I think it's always a very good idea to have the employee rule out particular jobs rather than the employer taking it upon themselves to say, well, so-and-so would never accept that job. Just again, to give an example from a real case I had a few years ago, we had an individual who was being made redundant in Liverpool, and it was a big national organization, and there was a job that he could have done down in Eastbourne. So, you know, you're talking hundreds of miles between the two, and the employer didn't put that job forward to him. I think assumed that there was no way the individual would move all the way from Liverpool to Eastbourne for the sake of that new job. In reality, I'm not perhaps surprised that the employer didn't think the individual would be interested, but the twist with this was that when the tribunal claim came in, turned out that the individual had elderly parents who lived in Eastbourne, and what he said was that he'd been thinking of moving down to being closer to his parents, so he would have taken that Eastbourne job. And if an individual is saying that at tribunal stage, it's really quite difficult for the employer then to justify why they never drew his attention to that job or offered it to him as suitable alternative employment.
When it comes to the appeal or an appeal that an employee can lodge, is there anything specifically that an employer needs to be mindful of?
Well, this is really the last chance to draw out and address any arguments that the employee might make before going to a tribunal. And I think the employer needs to keep a very open mind in these appeals so that the employee can raise any issues and so that they can then be fully considered and the employer provide a full response. It can be difficult to deal with issues at this stage, but it's certainly easier to deal with them at an appeal stage rather than to face them for the first time in tribunal. So if there's a point raised on appeal about why a particular job hasn't been made available to somebody as alternative employment, well, at the appeal stage, you can perhaps do something about that, but you almost certainly can't by the time it's gone to a tribunal.
So, Laurie, briefly, if we look at things like early conciliation or witness evidence and disclosure on redundancies in the tribunal, have you got any words of wisdom there for employers?
Yes, well, of course, these days the employee is going to have to go to early conciliation before launching their claim, and of course that provides a final opportunity to address any issues that might otherwise go to a tribunal. I always think it's very helpful if managers know through this process that they might be accountable for things like their scoring in an employment tribunal situation. That helps to focus their minds. And of course, it's not generally known that internal emails, so emails between, for example, HR and business managers, should be disclosed in a tribunal case. So you do need to be careful about that. Of course, none of that's a problem. If these redundancies are these genuine, honest redundancies, that I think is really the key to avoiding legal issues on redundancy. If you are being honest about your redundancies and open with the employees, then you've got nothing to fear about secret emails or communications coming to light in the tribunal process.
And so I think we've got a recent case that kind of demonstrates that quite well, don't we, Laurie?
Yes, it's the case of X against Y Limited. And the context here is that a bank had a senior lawyer who had brought disability discrimination claim against them and also raised a grievance about disability discrimination. What happened after that was that the individual in question went to a pub in London, actually, as it happens, a pub that's right next door to the Royal Courts of Justice, at which point he overheard two people talking about a lawyer at his particular bank having brought a disability discrimination claim. And just to give you a quote from the decision here, what he heard was that the woman said that there was a good opportunity to manage X, and that's the individual in question, out by severance or redundancy, as there was a big reorganization underway as a result of the bank's acquisition of another company. Following that, somebody anonymously sent him an email that had gone between the bank's lawyer and the bank itself. We don't know exactly what was said in that email, but we can get a flavor of it just from the judgment. It seems to be about dismissing the claimant or the individual in that case in the context of this redundancy. And just to give you again a couple of extracts from the judgment, it says the writer of the email records that the redundancy exercise provided, this is in quotes, their best opportunity, close quotes, of applying processes to the legal population, including the claimant. And the judge in this case finds, in the absence of any other explanation, the reference to, in the email, to risking impasse and proceedings with ongoing employment is a reference to the claimant.
It was interesting that email was taken, was allowed to be used as evidence, wasn't it? And that it wasn't covered by legal privilege?
Yes, that's right. The problem with that, and this was really the point of the judgment in the Employment Appeal Tribunal, was they said that if you're going to give advice on redundancies that is, as they put it, a cloak for dismissing this individual for other reasons, then you can't rely on that usual lawyer-client secrecy called legal privilege. So in other words, if you're going to attempt to take advantage of redundancy to dismiss somebody for other reasons, then you can't rely on that legal secrecy. That's really one of the central messages of this case. We don't know quite how this one's going to end up because there's been no final decision on the rights and wrongs of the dismissal, but you can see simply from that Employment Appeal Tribunal decision that the bank is in quite a lot of trouble here, none of which would have happened if they'd actually been open, straightforward, and honest in their redundancy procedures. But it is an example, quite a striking example, of how things can go wrong when you try and use redundancy to get rid of or to dismiss people where you've got something else perhaps in your mind when you're dismissing them.
Well, yes, that's kind of brought us full circle then, hasn't it, really, kind of reinforcing the principles that you were talking about when it comes to honest redundancies. And the reality is that employers do have other options if they want to manage individuals out of an organisation using performance procedures, etc. So thanks very much for joining us today, Laurie.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We have a wide range of tools available on the Expert HR site, including line manager briefings on both individual and collective redundancies. Thanks a million for joining us today, and do tune in again next time.